And the answer to that equation, man against man with a common denominator, the machine. The history of Grand Prix is a history of national pride. First it was the French, then the Italians, the Germans in the 30s, and for the past decade the English have taken a very special pride in the fact that they have been able to out-engineer their international rivals. A pride in their drivers as well. Ascari, Nuvolari, Fangio, Hill, Clark, Stewart are names that in their home countries connote the ultimate in bravery and sensitivity in competitive sport. It was just 26 years ago that the formula for construction of automobiles and the system for the points to be collected to decide the world championship were come upon. And since that time, it's been a race, form following function in one shape or another.
The crowd saw them as the sleekest refinements in the art of fabricating cars. Today, they seem like cumbersome prehistoric monsters with their masters rakishly mounted high in the cockpit. They were capable of great speed and equally capable of shaking one's dentures loose on suspension-busting courses. Early heroes, Italy's great Ascari and Nino Farina. Their competitors, Siam's Prince Bira. And from England, a very besmirched here, Peter Whitehead. It was a time of leather helmets and uniforms equally at home on tennis courts, where a pit stop wasn't quite the artistic ballet performed today, when portly gentlemen could still squeeze behind the controls. Grand Prix cars weren't as sensitive then. A spin like this wouldn't keep a soon-to-be world champion Mike Hawthorne from a fifth-place finish. Today, it would be a did-not finish and a $5,000 repair charge. The excellence of Grand Prix was Argentina's five-time world champion, Fangio. The elegance of Grand Prix has always been a constant. The glamour of the series has historically attracted the glamorous people. A sport of royalty, a young Prince Rainier oversaw the start of a Monaco Grand Prix. A Clark Gable was just another fashionable onlooker to the furious elbow-to-elbow competition. Danger is another constant of the game. Such crashes kept designers seeking equipment that would stick together and stay on the course. And drivers, led by the new English-speaking drivers, Dan Gurney, Tony Brooks, Phil Hill here, pioneered toward today's rear-engine racer. In the 60s, the low-slung car carried new champions to supremacy, Jimmy Clark three times. A young Jackie Stewart here was also to become three-time world champion. And there was John Surtees. And there was the master, Graham Hill.
Just a short distance from the Tower Bridge here in London are four teams that have dominated world championship racing in the past decade. And our expert commentator, we'd like to welcome Stirling Moss to CBS.
Thank you.
A gentleman who has won more Grand Prix than any other Englishman in history, perhaps can shed some light on why the English have dominated, not for a decade, but actually 20 years now.
Well, I think it's because up until, we had a lady Minister of Transport, we didn't have a speeding limit, and therefore we were able to enjoy our driving. Would that be the reason?
Well, but seriously, there have been so many great names to come from here. There must be more to it than that.
Well, I think a lot of it was to do with the fact that we're a small country, very individualistic, and I think that because we were fighting against the Germans and the Italians and the French in racing, I think that when there was the opportunity for us to get together and develop a car and an engine, we did it. And I think the drivers got together and just tried harder, if you like.
Well, last year they were defeated by the Italians. Let's take a look at what 1976 may have to offer.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really exciting year. There are all sorts of drivers who are ready to take over the title if they can, and also many cars who can assist them.
The heroes of the game. Mario Andretti, Stirling, 14th out of 53 drivers last year. As a child, he had only one hero, the Tiger, Ascari. And now at 35, with 33 Grand Prix races behind him, a Tiger himself.
John Watson from Northern Ireland, 29. He'll be driving for Penske this year. His best results were fourth in Austria, fifth in the US, both in 1974.
For the past several years, they have said this man would be the next world champion. It has yet to happen, but he has all the credentials and a style uniquely his. Sweden's 31-year-old Ronnie Peterson. Seven Grand Prix victories, but his best performance last year was only a fourth at Monaco.
And this is Tom Price, a 26-year-old Welshman. Drove for the American Shadow Team last year and this. Scored points in five races in 75, finishing 10th in the championship.
Patrick Depailler, 31 years old from France. He's the former European Formula 2 champion. He's been 9th in the championship for the world the last two seasons, expected to be very strong this year.
Maybe Nürburgring in France, where the food is good.
Jody Scheckter, a 25-year-old South African, number one driver for Tyrrell, ranked among the world's fastest drivers, won his native Grand Prix in 75.
The aspiring German Jochen Mass, who won his first Grand Prix in Spain last year, he'll drive for McLaren.
And Ken, this is Carlos Pache, the Brazilian Brabham driver, who captured the South American passion for the sport by winning his native Brazilian Grand Prix last year.
Clay Regazzoni, Swiss, 36, Ferrari factory driver, nosed out for the world title by Emerson Fittipaldi in 74. He is in the Ferrari mold, always among the leaders in every race, but not always about at the finish.
And James Hunt from England, only 28, Hesketh last year, McLaren this. One of four drivers to win their first Grand Prix in 1975, making him a national hero at home.
And speaking of national heroes, here is the Argentine national hero these days, Carlos Reutemann, 33 years of age, the most successful Argentine driver since Fangio. He won the German Grand Prix in 1975. He could win the title this year.
And the simpatico Brazilian, Emerson Fittipaldi, who's 29. He left McLaren for Cooper Suka. With two world championships and two runners-up in the past 4 years, and who, with Niki Lauda, is the standard by which all other drivers are judged. Niki is 26, and drives for Ferrari, and is the world champion.
Niki Lauda won the world championship 1 year ago, Sterling. How do you rate him?
Niki Lauda, in my opinion, is the world champion because he's the best driver. I think he's a tremendously dedicated man, he's a very talented man, and a person who gets out there and wants to win, and he's got the full might of him, and I think it's a very powerful combination.
Well, do you think that we're going to remember him as we remember Fangio, as we remember Jimmy Clark?
Fangio, well, that's something else. I mean, I'm a great fan of Fangio's. He was 5 times world champion. I hope so, in a way, because I think that the sport can do with another Fangio, and I think that Niki is a good ambassador, and I think he's a good guy for it. So he's young enough. Maybe he will be another Fangio.
Well, Stirling Moss, let's right now take a look at how Niki Lauda won the world championship in 1975.
It all started, Ken, at the Monaco Grand Prix, which of course was the first win of the year for Niki Lauda and for Ferrari. Prince Rainier and the American Princess Grace continued their enthusiasm for Grand Prix racing, and Lauda continued his enthusiasm for the pole position on the starting grid. Ronnie Peterson, Tom Price, and James Hunt all joined him in the front in a race that began in steady rain. The slippery track conditions forced the drivers to choose rain tires. These really do increase the adhesion in the wet tremendously. Monaco differs from most other Grand Prix events in that the race is held over the city streets of Monte Carlo and not on a specially designed track.
Heretofore, this has been the only race of the streets. In 1976, that changes, Sterling. And it'll be Long Beach, California in March. First time that a world championship race has ever been held there, and CBS was there last fall for their Formula 5000, which was supposed to be a dress rehearsal. And I can tell you, they run a dress rehearsal like a command performance out there. The only thing they didn't have was the royalty, and if it's important, they'll appropriate an entire family. Long Beach in March will be one of the major events on CBS in our coverage of Grand Prix this year.
You know, Ken, the tight confines of a race like Monaco, or in fact Long Beach in March for that matter, test the agility of the car, and they only weigh about 1,400 pounds, rather than its pure speed, and the precision of the driver, rather than his ability to go just flat out.
Sterling, you won this race 3 times. Does racing through city streets have special meaning to you?
Yes, Ken, I guess it meant that I could see the pretty girl with a pale pink lipstick standing outside Oscar's bar rather better than you would on the normal track. You see, you get a much closer relationship between the drivers and the crowd. I think you'll see it when we get to Long Beach, which we're showing, of course, on CBS in March.
Here's David Niven watching this event with Niki Lauda now in command.
Niki had started at Monaco a distant 9th from the World Driving Championship, and his victory took him up to 3rd place. This win was Ferrari's first in Monaco for 20 years.
The Grand Prix circuit marched on into Belgium. Lauda was suddenly very much in the championship, Sterling, although still far behind Fittipaldi.
That's right, Ken, because the title is determined on a point system. But let me explain. You get 9 points if you win a race. 6 for second, 4 for third, then 3, 2, and 1 to the next 3 finishers. Only the first six earned valuable points. Now, as at Monaco, Niki Lauda again recorded the fastest time trials and earned the pole position. He had spent the winter between the seasons in testing and developing the new Ferrari, and it appeared that the efforts were paying off. For the second race in a row, Lauda put his bright red machine in front of the pack right at the start and dictated the race from there. Lauda displayed a maturity and cool intelligence to match his ability, and the Ferrari was displaying reliability and precise cornering to match its brute power.
Niki Lauda's victory in the Belgian Grand Prix in Ferrari number 12 over South Africa's Jody Scheckter number 3 suddenly put him in the lead for the World Championship, 2 points ahead of Fittipaldi. The remainder of Niki Lauda's greatest year will be seen after this. The Scandinavian Raceway in Anderstorp in Sweden became the arena for Lauda's attempt to make it 3 in a row.
In a contrast to the previous races, Ken, he found himself 3 rows back on the starting grid and back in the field in the opening laps. Then in a beautifully controlled drive, he began to move up, lap by lap, one place at a time. With only 10 of the 80 laps remaining, he surged into the lead and began to appear unbeatable. The Ferrari team had known too many frustrations in the past 10 years since their last World Championship to get excited. But with Lauda sitting on a hefty 10-point advantage to the halfway mark, they were more than optimistic.
Lauda's victory marked a 3-race sweep for the Ferrari team.
The tour then went to the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort and began what was becoming a tradition. Lauda once again taking the pole and once again bolting away at the start and dictating the pace. Zandvoort has a reputation for favoring the Ferrari design, and the Austrian was doing nothing to disprove it. While the other drivers groped around in heavy rain, Lauda enjoyed the one position without a car throwing spray up in your face, the lead. Then it began to dry, and the pit crews again proved to be the determining factor in a race. Ferrari worked with its usual speed and economy, putting Lauda back in the race in seconds, but the Heskis crew worked even more quickly, and James Hunt now sat in front of Lauda. For 150 miles, the Austrian fought to catch the young Englishman in the privately entered car of Lord Alexander Heskett. Two cars locked together as one.
Stirling Moss, what's it like competing so close together at 170 miles per hour?
If you're in the second car, it's much easier because the man in front has got all the pressure on him. He's the one who mustn't make any mistakes anywhere.
Well, Hunt made no mistakes this day. He drove the race of his life, and he streaked across the finish line a bare second ahead of Niki Lauda in the Ferrari. The Dutch victory proved to be the high water mark for Heskett Racing, while second place for Lauda gave him 6 more points toward the World Championship. But it was James Hunt and England's day.
Ken, any Grand Prix in France has got a special ambiance, but Niki Lauda also gave it continuity by earning his accustomed post once again at the head of the grid. And as in most races this year, Lauda bolted away from the crowd at the start. He was touching up to 190 miles an hour and methodically lapping at an average of 116. And as so often during the season, let the remaining issue be, who will finish second? Well, James Hunt and Joachim Mass contested that spot, their duel pushing them closer to the commanding Lauda, but never close enough. Lauda again drove with cool intelligence, his precise, effortless circuits almost disguising his blistering speed. With his fourth victory in 5 races, he had scored an incredible 42 points out of a possible 45.
Sterling, that's like returning 4 out of 5 straight kickoffs for touchdowns in American football. Incredible indeed. That was the word again at Monza, Italy, when Niki Lauda set a new course record to obtain the pole.
And did you know that he took the car, put it away, and went for a swim? That's confidence.
That's amazing.
As if written in the script, the Ferrari arrived at Monza with the opportunity of clinching the World Championship for both car and driver and in front of a home crowd. In most recent years, the Italian Grand Prix, of course, has determined the season's champions, but none of them has been a Ferrari, not in the whole decade. Now, Niki Lauda needed only one point, a finish in any of the first six places, to own the title. And he and his teammate, Clay Regazzoni, had put their brilliant red cars exactly where the huge Italian crowd could see them, right out in front on the starting grid. As the cars readied for the start, an entire nation was aware that the great tradition could be reborn within 2 hours. Ferrari had been in world championship races since it began, and had long been a compelling name in the sport. Men like Ascari, Fangio, Phil Hill, John Surtees, and Mike Hawthorne had all taken it to world championships, and Niki Lauda could soon be added to that list. A Ferrari victory at Monza would also tie in with the Lotus for the most Grand Prix wins in history. The red cars from Maranello had won at Monza 7 times before, but none were more important than their try for the 8th. The highest toll in cars is always right at the start, as Vittorio Bambilla is reminded by a burned out clutch. But the Ferrari's start was perfect, and Regazzoni and Lauda roared around Monza like a pair of fire engines in front of all the competition. Lauda was happy to tuck in behind his teammate, a second place finish being more than enough to cement the championship. Neither driver pushed their car to the limit, aware that each had led the race the previous year and each had been eliminated with a blown engine. While Ferrari was enjoying a perfect day, the other teams were compiling a list of troubles, all sorts of troubles. The torrid pace was taking its toll here in tyres. Only one driver was able to detach himself from the trailing pack and challenge the Ferraris, and that was Emerson Fittipaldi. Aware that his crown was being transferred, he caught and passed Lauda, thereby illustrating that he was not abdicating permanently.
The Ferrari flags were unfurled as Regazzoni blasted across, giving the Italian crowd an Italian victory. Seconds later, Niki Lauda gave this Italian crowd an Italian world championship in 1975, and it became an instant national holiday.
Stirling Moss, there's one element of this story which we haven't touched upon and very definitely have to, and that's the American story, which has been extremely dismal with one great exception in Phil Hill.
Yeah, but hold it, you've got a pretty interesting setup for this year.
We'll take a look at the American challenge for world supremacy and Grand Prix after this.
Don Nichols' shadow cars in their fourth year will lead the U.S. challenge. Connelly Jones' car with Mario Andretti, seen as stronger in 1976. Constructor Roger Penske, a man of the history of winning with a new automobile. We talked to Penske in Vail, Colorado.
Knowing racing as well as you do, and knowing the visibility that certain motorsports attract, why did you ever elect to go Formula One in the first place, Roger?
Well, I think that it's a goal which we haven't achieved in racing. We have been involved in Indianapolis, we've been involved in Can-Am and Trans-Am. We are now getting our feet wet in the NASCAR circuit with, of course, Bobby Allison. And really, Formula One is a world championship. You race in many different countries throughout the world, and we're Americans, we're from the United States. And really, I'd like to carry the American flag with us throughout the world, and it's kind of a personal thing. It's something that maybe we can say there's something we do better than anyone else, and that's a hard thing to say in life. You might be a great artist, you might be a great swimmer, but we're trying to have the best American racing team presented by a group of men from the United States throughout the world. When we go to Belgium, or we go to Spain, or we go to Italy, they'll say, geez, that's the American team, and we're going to try to be number one.
Delaware's Brett Lunger is the dark horse, a 10-year veteran currently in England preparing to drive for car owner John Surtees. We asked him why he had made the commitment to Grand Prix.
Oh, you can't deny the fact that Grand Prix racing really represents the very top of this profession. It is the only series in which you can be crowned as world champion. The other races, sure, they're difficult, the competition's good, but only in Grand Prix do you really find the very, very top of this profession. And after all, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it at the top.
Our greatest hope for success, Indianapolis winner, Daytona stock car champion, Mario Andretti.
One of my ultimate goals is Formula One, mainly because that's the first type of racing that I ever knew, that I ever really appreciated as just a young boy. And as I said, because of the way I started racing here, one thing or another, it just wasn't opportune for me to get involved any sooner. Now I think it's the time.
What does Grand Prix mean to Mario Andretti?
Well, at this point, it means everything. And as I said many times, this is the time that I'm going to devote every bit of my energies to just accomplish this particular goal. And again, for whatever it takes, that's what I'm going to go for and play as hard as I have to.
Only one American driver has been crowned world champion. Phil Hill in 1961 clinched the title with his victory in the Italian Grand Prix. Hill's love of cars is of more classic proportion these days. In Santa Monica, California, we found him restoring a 1927 Packard, an Enterprise now 6 years old in his detailed concern when we chatted.
Did you ever think back then that you would stand as a very lonely name, the United States up there?
No, I really didn't, to tell you the truth. I thought I was called America's first world champion. And then, you know, then the years went by, and then, gosh, finally it became only instead of first, and very strange that it's gone this long. 14 years.
Why?
Just a tough job.
Phil Hill will be joining us for some of the longer version programs of Grand Prix here on CBS this year, including the two American events at Long Beach and Watkins Glen. Some questions to Sterling Moss to wrap up this first half hour on Grand Prix 76. Ask you some drivers' names, you give me some reactions as to what they'll do this year.
Stick my neck out, that's what you
stick
mean.
Your neck out.
Okay.
Emerson Fittipaldi.
I think that Emerson is probably one of the most brilliant drivers around. I don't think he's hungry anymore, and I've just read that he's earning, I think, $100,000 a month, and perhaps he doesn't need to win that much this year.
Well, what about Mario Andretti?
Mario, I think, has got the talent, I think he's got the desire, I think he's got everything, with the one exception possibly, and that is he has not got the experience of racing Formula One races in Europe.
Do you see any outsiders coming through this year?
I see outsiders coming in to challenge Nicky. I see people like Tom Price. I think there's quite a lot of guys around, but...
James Hunt?
James Hunt's another one, but I think, quite honestly, that Nicky is starting with everything in his favor.
So you're saying that in two words,
Nicky Lauda
will be the world champion this year.
So, yeah.
We'll see about that. For Sterling Moss, this is Ken Squire, and we'll be following CBS's Grand Prix coverage around the world in 1976.